Good evening. It's good to see everyone back out again tonight. If you're visiting with us, we're very happy to have you and invite you to stay around after services so that we may get to know you a little better. In 1988, George Bush was elected President of the United States, as you all know. When he was elected to this position, there was a lot of prestige that came along with it. He gets to live in the White House. He gets all of the media attention that he wants, probably a little more than he wants sometime. He's driven in a limousine. He's got servants at his beck and call. But yet, with all of this prestige, Mr. Bush also had to take on a lot of other things. He had to deal with problems such as the one that's going on right now, whether to send troops into war. He has to deal with economic problems. How are we going to balance the budget? How are we going to pay for our bills? And another type of problem that he has to face with most every day are those problems of a moral nature. Surely that puts President Bush in a very precarious situation. Because when dealing with moral problems, you pretty well have the nation divided into two sides. And while one may say this is right, another group may say it's wrong. And in putting him in that position, he has to come out in favor of certain things. But yet, as Christians, we could tell President Bush, as well as all the leaders in Congress, as well as those justices on the Supreme Court, that any moral issue that comes up has already been decided long ago. Any decision that comes before the Supreme Court, the verdict came down thousands of years ago when the book of the Bible was given to us. Tonight, I would like for us to look at some of the present moral problems that we're facing in America. And in so doing, I would like for us to see where God has already told us long, long ago what we need to do in these situations. Perhaps the first thing we need to do is define what we talk about when we discuss moral problems. When we look up the word moral, that means deciding between what's right and what's wrong. And that puts us in a difficult situation sometimes, especially if we're in the public eye. Because what one group might say is right, as we said before, another might say is wrong. That means we have to go to the standard. No matter what the question is, we look and see what God says, and what He says, we live with it. And that settles it. One problem that has probably dominated the moral issues in the past few years more than any other is that of abortion. We know that in the early 1970s, our Supreme Court in our nation decided that abortion was legal. They decided, after examining the Constitution and discussing opinions and hearing cases, that abortion was okay. And thus they took away the ban on abortion, thus making it legal in America. And ever since that time, the nightly news, the papers, the magazines, have been filled with arguments from both sides. One group arguing that, yes, the Supreme Court made the right decision. Abortion is legal and it's everyone's right to have it. But on the other hand, we also see another group that says, no, it's wrong. And when we turn back to the Scriptures, we'll see where it's wrong. What we have to do is examine what God said about the issue. And if we go to our concordances and try to look up Scriptures, we won't find the word abortion anywhere used in the Bible. But I believe when we take passages and join them together and look at the Scriptures as a whole, we see God clearly speaking out on the issue of abortion. What's the dividing line on the question? Well, one group would say the dividing line is deciding when life begins. Whenever life begins, that should be the cutoff point for abortion. But who are we going to trust to tell us then? As we go back to the Scriptures, we find where God talks about this in certain cases. We'll be looking at two passages from the book of Job and then two from the book of Psalms, and we'll see what God had to say about when life began. First of all, in Job 31 in verse 15, we read where Job says, "Did not He who made me in the womb make them? Did not the same one fashion us in the womb?" It seems that from the writings and the speakings of Job here, that we see Job talking about God knowing him before he was ever born. He says, while I was still in the womb, God had dealings with me. Looking at another passage from the book of Job, in Job 10 and verse 8, your hands have fashioned me an intricate unity. Well, what are these passages saying? They're saying that long before this man was ever born, long before this man ever saw the light of day, while he was still in his mother's womb, God knew who he was, and God recognized him as a living person. Continuing on in looking at some of these passages, we see in Psalm 139, verses 13 and 15, "For you have formed my inward parts. You have covered me in my mother's womb. My frame was not hidden from you when I was made in secret." Once again, echoing the same thoughts that we've been discussing. And finally, in Psalm 71 and verse 6, "By you I have been upheld from my birth. You are he who took me out of my mother's womb." All of these passages point to one fact, that God recognized the child as a living being before he was ever born into this world. If we go out into the world today, and we try to ask experts, ask doctors, ask people who study anatomy, when does life begin? We will have answers ranging all the way from the time of conception to the time right before the child is born. And I ask you, if we put our faith in those experts, if we put our faith in those doctors, which one are we going to trust? If we have just a multiplicity of answers, who's going to be right? Because all it is opinion. What I say to you tonight is we need to look at what God said. And if God recognizes a child as a living being before he is ever born into this world, the same should be true for us. And we should recognize that also. When someone asks me the question, when does life begin? I would say as soon as we know there's a child there, because that's when God recognized it. Another point comes up when we discuss abortion. A lot of times we hear experts say, and we hear people on TV arguing back and forth, is it not the woman's decision whether she should have this child or not? And that's a valid point. You know that in carrying a child, you ladies who have ever had a child, know that when you have a child in your body, that it's yours. You're the one responsible for it. You're the one taking care of it. So when someone presents us with this situation, when someone asks us the question, is it not the woman's choice, what will our answer be? How will we respond to such a comment? Once again, I don't mean to be repetitive, but the same point applies. Go back to those scriptures that we just looked at. Go back and see what God said about it. In all four of those cases, who was credited with forming the child? Was it not God? Was he not the one given the credit by Job? And I am not trying to any way demean a woman's position in giving birth. Because if you have carried a baby, you know what you have to go through. There's the sickness that you put up with. There's the back pains you have to put up with. But do we not need to go back and see that God is the one ultimately responsible for forming that child? Yes, I believe a woman has a choice. And I believe a man has a choice. And I believe that comes before the child is ever conceived. The choice comes in deciding whether or not to have a child. When men and women decide to join together in relations, that's when the situation arises. That's when the choice is made. When we study abortion, we know that a great majority of abortions occur because when men and women join together in fornication, or they join together in an adulterous affair. And then when a child comes along, the problem is presented. Am I going to carry this child when I don't have a husband? Am I going to carry this child when perhaps it was formed by another man, not my husband? You see, the choice came. And the woman and the man decided together to make the wrong choice. What we have to realize is what God has said about these situations. What has God said about fornication? He tells us plainly and clearly what can arise when we choose to practice these sins. Three passages I'd like for us to look at. The first one in Matthew, the 15th chapter. What has God told us about the sin of fornication? In Matthew, the 15th chapter, we read in verse 19, "For out of the heart proceed evil thoughts, murders, adulteries, fornications, thefts, false witness, blasphemies." What is God saying about it? What He's saying is that you decide in your heart if you're going to take part in this sin. He says, just if you decide to blaspheme Me, just as if you decide to murder someone, the choice is made in your heart. Continuing on now, looking in 1 Corinthians, the 6th chapter, we read in verse 9 of this chapter, "Do you not know that the unrighteous will not inherit the kingdom of God? Do not be deceived. Neither fornicators, nor idolaters, nor adulterers, nor homosexuals, nor sodomites." Go down to verse 18. "Flee sexual immorality. Every sin that a man does is outside the body. But he who commits sexual immorality sins against his own body." Turn back a page to 1 Corinthians, the 5th chapter, and verse 9. "I wrote to you in my epistle not to keep company with sexually immoral people. Yet I certainly did not mean with the sexually immoral people of this world, or with the covetous, or extortioners, or idolaters, since then you would need to go out of the world." What's the point that we need to make here? What God is saying is this, that you decide in your heart if you're going to commit this sin. And people say, yes, you can get caught up in the moment and one thing leads to another. But I'm saying that God says you ultimately made that decision. It's not something that just happens. The decision ultimately flows from your heart. Now, how does that tie back into abortion? As we stated, many abortions, most abortions occur because a woman has a child and the man and the woman don't know what to do with it. You see, if we could eliminate the one sin, then we wouldn't be faced with the other. If we could eliminate it in the very beginning, we wouldn't place people in this particular situation, and they wouldn't place themselves in that particular situation. When is the choice made? The choice is made when you decide to have a baby. Yes, I believe that the man and woman both have a choice to make. And yes, I believe that we can recognize that the child is a living being from the very beginning. And when I put all of these passages together and I look at the issue as a whole, all I can see is that God has said that child should be recognized and that child should not be murdered. Now, many would scorn me for saying that. Many would laugh at me for coming to that decision. I was flipping through the channels the other day and I happened to come across a comedian. And he was dealing with this very subject. And he said, boy, those pro-lifers, maybe they should be called pro-population explosion. Well, what was he saying? He was basically saying that if you decide that you're pro-life, as we put it in political terms, if you decide that abortion is wrong, that basically you're taking away a right that should belong to a woman, and you're basically placing that woman, as well as the entire country, in a situation where it doesn't need to be. All I can say to that is, God has said it's wrong. And that's enough for me. And it should be enough for anyone who can go back and read God's Word. It should be enough for our political leaders who go up on the hill every day and make these decisions. We must purpose in our hearts what God has said and then act on it from that point. Another moral issue that we have been faced with quite dramatically in the past few years is that of gay rights. We ask ourselves, when did all of this come about? I've heard many people say that you used to didn't hear things like that on TV. You used to didn't hear people talking about such things as that. Well, what made the change? Well, sociologists would tell us and psychologists would tell us that in the late 1960s and early 1970s, America passed through a revolution. And in this revolution, things that were once secret, Things that were once thought immoral were now opened up, and America had a new understanding about them. And they would say that these things that were once considered dark and dreary and sinful can now be brought out into the open. Since this time, we have seen the rise of gay rights, as they've been called. We see clubs, organizations, fraternities, sororities, business meetings, all of these things open up to people who profess to be homosexuals. And the reason that they're done is to give a new positive light to these people who choose to practice such things. Yes, it's a relatively new problem to America. Yes, it hasn't been that many years that it's come about, but as we look back in our history and we study ancient civilizations, we know this problem is as old as the Scriptures itself. As we look back in time and as we look back into the recordings of the Scriptures, we see where God has spoken very loudly and very clearly on this situation. And I would like for us to look at some of the things that God has said about it. If you have your Bibles, turn back to the book of Leviticus. In Leviticus, the 18th chapter, we have God giving His law to Moses. We have God speaking out on many types of issues in this law. And I'd like for us to first of all read the first five verses of this chapter, because in them we'll see where God is clearly telling the people His intentions on the coming things that He's about to discuss. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, we read in verse 1, "Speak to the children of Israel, and say to them, I am the Lord your God, according to the doings of the land of Egypt, where you dwell. You shall not do, and according to the doings of the land of Canaan, where I am bringing you, you shall not do, nor shall you walk in their ordinances. You shall observe my judgments and keep my ordinances to walk in them. I am the Lord your God. You shall therefore keep my statutes and my judgments, which if a man does, he shall live by them. I am the Lord." In those first five verses there, God is coming out and He's telling the people, I am fixing to tell you how to live. I'm fixing to tell you the things that you had better not participate in. Now, after reading that, go down to verse 22. Very clearly in verse 22, He says, "You shall not lie with a male as with a woman. It is an abomination." Go on down now to verses 29 and 30. "For whoever commits any of these abominations, the person who commits them shall be cut off from among the people. Therefore you shall keep my ordinances, so that you do not commit any of these abominable customs where were committed before you, and that you do not defile yourselves by them. I am the Lord your God." Truly, the children of Israel should not have had any question in their mind what God was saying. Clearly, He comes out and says, this is something that is wrong. Going on over to chapter 20, we read in verse 13 what God said to do with someone who practices homosexuality. In verse 13, He says, "If a man lies with a male as he lies with a woman, both of them have committed an abomination. They shall surely be put to death. Their blood shall be upon them." Is there any question that God held this as a despicable sin? That He held it as something which was ultimately and absolutely against all of His beliefs? I think we have no problem in seeing that. One more passage I'd like for us to look at here in the Old Testament is in the book of 1 Kings. In 1 Kings, the 14th chapter, and verse 24, we read, First Kings 14 and verse 24, "And he did evil in the sight of the Lord. He did not depart from all the sins of Jeroboam the son of Nebat, he who made Israel sin." Once again, we see where God held in disesteem. We see where God held in certain respects that sins were wrong. And just as we read here, and just as we read back in the book of Leviticus, God dealt severely with these sins. God said, if you do it, you're going to die for it. However, many people would tell us that that's the God of the Old Testament. That when He gave us the new law, He changed all of these things. And He let people decide in their hearts what's right and what's wrong. Is that what he did? Just as we look here in the Old Testament concerning these things, we can look at the New Testament and we can see God echoing the same thoughts. In the writings of Paul to the Romans, in chapter 1 and verse 24 beginning, we read where God says the same thing that He did in those days. In Romans, the first chapter, beginning in verse 24, we read, "Therefore God also gave them up to uncleanness in the lust of their hearts, to dishonor their bodies among themselves, who exchanged the truth of God for the lie, and worshipped and served the creature rather than the Creator, who is blessed forever. For this reason God gave them up to vile passions, for even their women exchanged the natural use for what is against nature. Likewise also the men, leaving the natural use of the woman, burned in the lust for one another, men with men committing what is shameful and receiving in themselves the penalty of their error which was due." We can go to Galatians, the 5th chapter, and numerous other chapters, and see where God says one of the works of the flesh is homosexuality. What is God saying about it? He is saying, just as it was wrong in the days of Moses, and just as it was wrong in the days of my prophets, it's just as wrong for you to commit such atrocities today. But yet, when we go out in the world, we hear many things about this particular issue. One of the most prevalent is, well, they just can't help it. They were born that way. It's an alternate lifestyle. At a place where I worked this summer, some of my fellow employees and myself were eating lunch one day, and somehow the issue came up, and one of the employees there said, "They just can't help it. That's the way they are." Well, is that true? Is a person born in such a state that he just can't help it? That he must choose this so-called alternate lifestyle because that's the way he was formed? Well, what I would say is this. We have just looked throughout the entire Scriptures at what God said about homosexuality. And in every case, without exception, He said it was wrong. And I would have to ask this question. Is God saying that I'm placing something there before you that's wrong, but you can't help it, so you're going to be wrong in doing it? Is that the type of God we have? Not at all. What our God says is that you may have a problem with a certain case, and you may have a sin placed in front of you, but you can overcome it. We can take comfort in such passages as 1 Corinthians 10:13, where God says, "I'm not going to let a sin come before you that you can't overcome. I'm not going to let Satan sling an arrow at you that you won't be able to dodge." What's God saying? He's saying you may have the desire there, just as you do with any other sin, but I will provide a way of escape. We look at many other sins that people commit. Some people steal. Some people drink. Some people use drugs. And we don't say, well, psychologists might, but the normal people doesn't say, well, those people are just choosing an alternate lifestyle. That's the way they were born. No, you don't hear that about other sins. Why should it be any different with the sin of homosexuality? We have got to realize what God has said about it. And it may be that someone has the temptation in front of them. And it may be that someone is drawn to live in that way. But God has said it's wrong. And He said, I will allow you a way of escape from that. Some people have also said that God has sent AIDS to rid the world of homosexuals. That God has sent AIDS as a plague on the homosexuals. Well, I don't know if that's true or not, whether God sent it directly. But I do know this, that God had set laws from the very beginning, that if they were violated, certain consequences would come. And we know that when certain other sins are entered into, that they will have consequences. If we enter into the sin of drinking to excess, then we know that our body will pay certain consequences. We know that if we use drugs, our body will pay certain consequences. I think the same thing is true here. Whether God has sent this directly or not, we know that if we avoid the sin, we will avoid the consequence that has been set from the very beginning. Do I believe that the homosexual can overcome his ways? Yes, I do. Because it's a sin just as any other. Now, I present this question to you. God has said you need to deal with these moral issues. He's told us to have an answer ready and to take action to teach others these moral issues. Now, going back to abortion and going back to gay rights, what should be the Christian's response to these things? What if you're presented with the question of abortion? What if someone asks you about it? What's going to be your response? The Christian should realize that on an individual basis, he or she needs to be ready to give an answer to any moral question that's put before him or her. And if the question of abortion comes up, the Christian should have a ready response to it. When we look at the political side of this, and we see the people out there demonstrating on the streets, and we see them rallying, you know what one of the biggest problems is with the side that we call pro-life? And you know what one of the biggest problems is on the side that we call pro-abortion? It's the fanatics on each end. They don't really know why they believe it. They just know it's wrong, or they just believe it's right, and they don't have any facts to back up their case. And when you see these people inevitably being interviewed on TV, you get the weirdest and the kookiest ones most of the time. Well, is that the way the Christian needs to be? The problem is that those people didn't have a ready answer. Is that the way we're going to be? That's the worst possible situation we could place ourselves in. That is the worst possible case that we could ever present to someone. What we have to do is sit down with our Bibles and study the issue out. What does God say about it? What does He tell us to do about it? And then when we have that knowledge, we are then equipped to go out and teach the world about it. What else can the Christian do? This may sound extreme, but I believe that if a Christian couple, if at all possible, should be ready to take a child into their home who might otherwise be aborted. Yes, that's going to place the family in a struggle, maybe. Yes, that might present a financial burden on the family. But this is my point, that if a family can do that, then they're preventing that mother from committing a sin. They're preventing a murder from taking place and that child having its life taken away. And the Christian family has come out loudly and strongly that they will do whatever it takes to rid this country of the problem. Yes, it may sound extreme, but we're dealing with an extreme scenario here. We need to be ready to do whatever possible. From a political side, we need to elect leaders who are going to take a stand against these issues. I'm in no way trying to join together church and state or make a church into a political club as we see sometimes. But what I am saying, if we believe it's right to vote, if we believe in electing leaders, then we had better listen to them and see where they come out on these issues. Because they're the ones who are going to be in the public eye. And virtually millions of people will be influenced by what their leaders say. So let's be ready to come out loudly and strongly and elect leaders who will take the proper stand. What else should the Christian do? The Christian should have his trust in God. If a family is put in a situation where a child comes along rather unexpectedly, and the couple says, "I just don't believe we can handle this financially," have a little more trust in God. He's not going to let you starve. He's not going to let you get so low that you have nothing to eat and the whole family goes without food. He's going to provide a way for you. So if you're a Christian and this child comes along, don't despair. Put that desperation into God, and He will provide an answer for us. You see, the Christian has many things that he can do in fighting this problem. The Christian can take strong and firm action to stand tough when moral issues such as this come along. Well, what about when we have the issue of gay rights come along? What should be the Christian's response to that? I'll tell you this, that if a brother or sister comes along and they come asking our forgiveness for being involved in this particular sin, we had better accept them just like we would anyone else who comes along asking forgiveness. There's a lot of prejudice in the world against this particular sin. And I'm saying we need to hate the sin because it's abominable before God. But the sinner we should still love. And if this person comes to us asking us to help them get over this sin, if this person comes asking our forgiveness, we had better accept them with open arms just as we would anyone else. This situation happened at a congregation I know of. And I'm sure those people were put in a very precarious situation because we hear all of the jokes and all of the things that are said about this sin. And I'm sure it was very hard for those members to accept this particular person. But God has said, if a brother comes to you and asks for your forgiveness, then you had better forgive him, because that's what God does. President Bush is placed in a tough situation, but no more tough than any that we're placed in. We are faced with the same problems. We're faced with the same moral issues that everyone else in this nation is. And the determining factor in it is if we're going to sit down and find out what God said and then be able to articulate that intelligently to others when they ask our opinion. When we have a moral issue come before us, be ready with an answer for it. Be ready, and be ready in the knowledge of God. This lesson has not been aimed to embarrass anyone. I realize that the information we've dealt with is oftentimes the butt of jokes, and is oftentimes in such a way that we don't take it seriously. But what we need to do is to realize that God has spoken loudly and clearly on these issues, and it's up to Him to decide what's right or wrong. If you need to make a response to the invitation tonight, if you're ready to turn your life over to God and be joined in the body of His Son with all of the others in this room, or if you've been involved in some sin and you need to make corrections tonight, God has given you at least one more opportunity to do that. I can't think of a better time to do it. Won't you please respond to the invitation while we stand and sing?